It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. This is episode 784 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 27, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. We've got War Games in the books. Another late night, 2 pay-per-views in a row, 2 weekends in a row. War Games is over. I've got a lot to say about the Bloodline stuff, where it looks to be headed, where it should be headed. Randy Orton's career in serious jeopardy. The Elite get heat for trolling CM Punk in Chicago, Cain Velasquez out on bail for attempted murder and wrestling again, and tonight, for the first time since 2010, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat will step back into a professional wrestling ring, likely for the final time, to team with FTR against Jay Lethal, Brock Anderson, and a mystery partner to be managed by Arn Anderson. This is at the Big Time Wrestling Show in North Carolina. I think this is streaming on Fight TV, I believe. You know that Ric Flair is at home saying, it should have been me. It still could be. He could turn out to be the Mystery Man. You know that he would love to be the Mystery Man. You guys got 1 day left to take advantage of this Black Friday sale on Pro Wrestling Tees. Get 20% off any shirt in our store, including the new 15-year anniversary sound up.
Oh my! Could you try again?
Oh my God! Even Siri wants to get in on the sale. Look at this! Look at this woman. She wants to get in on this. You can't have the discount, Siri. This does not apply to you. You need to be a human being with flesh and blood. So shut the fuck up. But you can take advantage of it. Go to prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. 20% off. You have until, I want to say it's 1 o'clock Eastern tomorrow, so do not let that discount expire. If you would like to support the podcast, you may make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to show some love for our PayPal producers here this week, the final sound-off of the month of November. Only 1 month left in the year. Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, who also popped in on the stream the other night and dropped a hundy bomb. Paul, you're awesome. Thank you, Paul. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big B, Bryant Becerra, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Killshot, Keith Hart, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. I believe Willie and his and Mama Eichard were at the AEW show the other night, I believe. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison, Soap, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Shin Superkick Akuma, Caleb Showtime Lindley. You want to hear a wild superkick story, you're going to want to stick around for the Tales from the Territories review a little bit later on. Nathan wanted to show some love for his fiancée, Jessica. He wants her to know that he is thinking of her and is forever grateful for all that she does. He said that she wakes up every day and continues to be the best partner, an awesome mom, and just an overall blessing in his life. So I hope that you two had a very happy Thanksgiving. And check out the Lightning Link Lounge. If you like playing games online and you want to try to win some money, you can check out the Lightning Link Lounge. You can play slots like Lightning Link, Dragon Link, Buffalo, Keno, poker games like Texas Hold'em, Blackjack, and Roulette. Thousands of games to choose from, and they pay winners daily. I've had some fun in the past playing Dragon Coin and Candy Heroes. For more information, you can search for Lightning Link Lounge on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. You must be 18 years or older to play. Ages may vary outside the U.S. An ID is required. You can text 727-910-8809 to get started. Last night was Survivor Series, first edition of War Games on the main WWE roster. And for years, Survivor Series has been Raw versus SmackDown, right? It's a tired concept. It hasn't really meant much in a very long time. You know, you're going to have a competition like that where you're going to put the brands against each other. It'd be nice to have some stakes. They never even bothered to add any real stakes to it. It was just a lazy way of booking Survivor Series every single year because it was their tried and true, and they just couldn't be bothered to come up with something a little bit more fun or a little bit more unique. So the idea that Survivor Series was the one time a year you could see Raw versus SmackDown and SmackDown versus Raw talents. Yeah, I said this on the stream last night. I actually admired the balls on them to just lie through their teeth to all of us, to you and me, like we were just a bunch of idiots. 20 years ago, Triple H wanted to bring War Games to Survivor Series. And Vince McMahon said no. He thought it was too WCW. Triple H, 15 years later, brought War Games to NXT. And that was the dry run for what we got last night. Once Vince McMahon stepped down earlier this summer, Triple H finally got his wish. It took 20 years, but he finally got his wish. And I would like to look at last night as a step towards restoring past glory for a show that has long been devoid of any real glory. Hopefully last night was a step towards restoring Survivor Series as one of the big four annual events that I grew up on. You know, when I grew up, it was the big four. Then they added King of the Ring, but it was still the big four. And Money in the Bank has sort of taken that mantle in recent years. It would be nice for Survivor Series to be looked at that way again. When the show was over, I thought overall it was a very good show overall. This was not my favorite Survivor Series in the last 10 years or anything like that, but I thought it was a pretty good show overall. But the best part of the entire show was the Bloodline and the Bloodline story. Everything has been built around the Bloodline, and it should be because it really is the best thing going right now in this company. If you take out the Bloodline story, you take out the Sami Zayn stuff, remove that from WWE television, what are you really left with? You're not left with much. So at least they have that story going for them. And the main event was built around the Bloodline stepping into the ring with a bunch of men who have been wronged by the Bloodline in the past. The Brawling Brutes have felt the wrath of the Bloodline. Sheamus was put out with an injury by them. Kevin Owens has been screwed over by them. Drew McIntyre has been screwed over by them. So it made sense for them to unite to try to take down the Bloodline. That main event last night, that War Games match, was all about the story. It wasn't about the holds, and it wasn't about the dives, and it wasn't about any of the weapons that were brought into the cage. It was about the story. The storytelling was on point last night with Sami Zayn finally being accepted as a true member of the family. I thought it was outstanding. It was an outstanding finish to what overall I thought was a very good War Games match. The finish is just what put it over the top for me. And you have that image at the very end, you know, not just Roman Reigns embracing Sami Zayn now that he feels like he could trust him. And everything they did on that show was building to that moment. They had a couple of backstage segments. Roman brought Sami into his dressing room so he could ask him point blank, what did you discuss with Kevin Owens on SmackDown last night? I need to know that you're loyal to us. You're not going to stab us in the back. Sami said, nope, I'm all in on the Bloodline. But you could tell Roman didn't trust him. Then during the match, Jimmy Uso goes to leave the little shark cage to enter War Games, and Roman says, no, no, you stay here. He points at Sami, you go. You go to the ring. You save Jey Uso. You prove your worth to the Bloodline. Every little thing they did set up the finish of this match. And when the match was over and Sami was embraced by Roman Reigns, the next person who came running over to hug Sami Zayn was Jey Uso, and it got the biggest pop of the entire show. Huge reaction when Jey Uso finally came over to embrace Sami Zayn. Not once, not twice, but three times he hugged this man. He was so happy. And they have seemingly put their differences behind. It was a great moment. That was the payoff, even though it was only the next chapter of a longer story. Jey Uso, by the way, may have a broken hand. I went back to watch both War Games matches because sometimes, you know, in taking notes, there are things I may not pick up on the first time. Case in point, the finish to the women's War Games match, which I will call myself out on here in a few minutes. But there is a point in the men's match right before Kevin Owens entered where the Bloodline is setting up a table in one of the rings, and you can hear Jey Uso tell Sami Zayn and Jimmy that his hand is broken. He can't help them. And that was the hand that was already taped up coming into the match. He had a wrist injury where they thought maybe his wrist might have been broken. This is before Crown Jewel. But it turned out not to be broken, even though he's been wearing tape on it now for a few weeks. And he was favoring the hand for the rest of the match. So hopefully that is not the case. Again, his hand injury did not play into any story in the match. I just hope, it's not serious, and hopefully it's not actually a broken hand. But when this thing was over, it was all about Sami Zayn no longer an honorary Uso, now an official Uso. Where do they go from here? That's the million-dollar question now. Now War Games is in the rear view. Where do they go from here with this story? They didn't turn on Sami. In fact, they doubled down, and they welcomed him into their family in a way that they haven't before. So where do you go from here? If they're all on the same page now, one thing that could cause a rupture in the bloodline would be Sami Zayn winning the Royal Rumble match. Now, I still think that Cody Rhodes should win the Royal Rumble. I still think that Cody Rhodes is the odds-on favorite. I think it comes down to Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins in the end. But just imagine for a second, if the Royal Rumble match came down to Cody Rhodes and Sami Zayn, who would the crowd cheer for? Who would the crowd cheer more for? Because I guarantee you, an equal number of people, if not more, would be wanting to see Sami Zayn win that match if it came down to the two of them. And then, of course, you still have the issue of Roman Reigns having both belts. They still haven't split the championships, which I thought by now they would do, but they haven't. It looks like they're going to go the full year. Roman unified them at WrestleMania last year. It looks like they're at least going to go the full year with those titles unified. And what happens now is it's created a real issue heading into WrestleMania, because if there is any chance of The Rock wrestling Roman Reigns, it should not be for the championship, either one. And The Rock is not winning the Royal Rumble match, nor should he. It's too late for them to just randomly announce that they're going to split the belts. They were going to do that. They should have did that months ago. There would have to be a storyline explanation for that. Could Roman Reigns enter himself into the Royal Rumble and put the titles or one of his titles on the line? I mean, he could. Why the hell would he do that? That would be very dumb. Why would he only put one of them on the line? So that doesn't make any sense. If Sami Zayn were to win the Royal Rumble, we're trying to map this out here. If Sami Zayn is in the Royal Rumble match and wins, to show his loyalty to the bloodline, does he forfeit his title shot at WrestleMania? I mean, that would render the Royal Rumble match meaningless. But you're already doing that, I guess, by doing Rock against Roman, if that's the direction they go in, unless you have Rock against Roman on night one, with Roman defending his titles against the Royal Rumble winner on night two. See, that's the benefit of having two nights of WrestleMania instead of one. Elimination Chamber is in Montreal in February. How can you not have a match on that show with Roman Reigns defending against Sami Zayn? How do you not do that? Or at least include the two of them in the Elimination Chamber match and shoot the angle there to kick him out of the bloodline, which then leads to him and Kevin Owens challenging the Usos for the tag team titles at WrestleMania. I have heard the arguments that Sami Zayn is so over, right? I saw it on my own timeline last night when that pay-per-view was over. The argument that Sami Zayn is so over right now, the tag team titles feel beneath him. Sami Zayn should be challenging Roman Reigns, and he should be the one to take those titles from Roman, and they could put the Cody story off for another year. Sami is so great right now, and he is so over with the audience. I would love to see Sami Zayn get his flowers. I would love to see Sami Zayn get his big crowning moment, because he has been the very best part of WWE television now for months. He may not be big and menacing like Brock Lesnar or Bobby Lashley and as believable as them, and he just lost to Johnny Knoxville this year at WrestleMania. So to think that he would be the man after 2.5 years to dethrone Roman Reigns the very next year after what he did at WrestleMania this year, it sounds preposterous. But is it? Is it really? I don't think it is at all. The ladder match idea that I talked about months ago with Roman Reigns against Seth Rollins, each man pulls down one title, that's their way of splitting them. Rollins gets the WWE title. Roman holds on to the Universal title to keep that reign, you know, going, since that was the first championship that he won. That, you know, when they talk about 900 plus days as champion, they're talking about the Universal title. They're not really talking so much about the WWE title. But that ladder match idea would have been perfect as a way to split the titles, and it would have solved a lot of these problems. But they didn't do that, and now they've got to figure out things pretty fast because the Royal Rumble is coming up next. There is no day one. There is no pay-per-view in December. The next pay-per-view is the Royal Rumble. They've got 8 weeks to figure things out. And I don't know what they're going to do as far as the actual Rumble match goes. WrestlingNews.co this morning is reporting that the title match for the Royal Rumble is going to be Roman Reigns defending against Kevin Owens, which would not only be their third title match at a Royal Rumble pay-per-view, 2017, 2021, and now 2023. They had Sheamus penciled in. I guess they had Sheamus penciled in originally, but they're going to go with KO. If they do that, this would be their second ever championship match at a Royal Rumble inside the Alamo Dome, because their first Rumble match in 2017 was in that same building. That was the one where Chris Jericho was suspended above the ring in a shark cage. Kevin Owens won that match. Kevin Owens did not win their last match at the Royal Rumble. This would be match number three. So it sounds like instead of Sheamus, they're going to go with KO. And it makes sense if you think about it, because Owens last night had Roman Reigns beat. It wasn't Sheamus, it wasn't Drew McIntyre, it was Kevin Owens. He had Roman beat, were it not for Sami Zayn grabbing the referee's hand before it could come down to count that three count and prevented KO from winning the match. Owens can play up the fact now on TV, hey, I had Roman beat with the pop-up powerbomb and the stunner. If it wasn't for Sami Zayn, I would have won my match for War Games for my team. Roman defends against KO at the Royal Rumble. He defends against Sami Zayn at Elimination Chamber. We get the reunion between Owens and Zayn. KO and Sami, they go on to win the tag team titles at WrestleMania. That is how this should go. I'm sticking to my guns on that. I know it's very tempting. The story of Sami Zayn being the one to take down the Tribal Chief, it would be incredible. If I were booking this, if I were in the Triple H chair, I would be very tempted to go in that direction. But I also have to look at the bigger picture, and I have to look beyond WrestleMania and think to myself, whoever takes those titles from Roman Reigns needs to be set up as the guy. Whoever beats Roman Reigns should not be a short-term champion. Whoever beats Roman Reigns, you know, should not be cashing in a Money in the Bank briefcase after Roman has already wrestled a long match. You know, you can't do that. They need to go over strong, they need to go over decisively, and they need to be set up to be the top guy. Sami Zayn is not going to be set up to be the top guy. It's just not going to happen. I think he and Kevin Owens are being set up to take the tag team titles, which I know they've wanted their entire careers to be tag team champions at least once, you know, in WWE. I'm not talking about with El Generico and Ring of Honor. Nobody else has been set up to take those titles away from Jimmy and Jay. They've got the tag team division on lockdown. Until somebody comes along. There are no other good options. When it comes to the tag team division right now, there are no other viable good options. But there are other options that Triple H has when it comes to who should be Roman Reigns. But I will say this. The best thing that Vince McMahon did in his final months with that company was re-sign Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn to new deals. And it's the best thing that Owens and Zayn could have done for their careers, because there was nothing they would be doing in AEW right now that would top what they have done this year. They handled their business privately. There was a lot of speculation online about what they would do, and there were certain teases. Remember the Young Bucks, who were very good friends with Owens, were posting stuff on their Twitter bio and stuff, getting people talking. But they handled their business privately and quietly before they came out publicly to announce that they had re-signed. But it was the last great thing that Vince McMahon did because of how valuable they had both been to that company this year alone. Owens got to live his dream and work a WrestleMania main event against Stone Cold Steve Austin. Anything he does after this is just gravy. Winning the tag titles with Sami may actually be the only goal or dream that he has left. But he worked a WrestleMania main event with Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then you look at the Bloodline stuff that Sami has been doing, which has been outstanding. So that is something I can sit here and thank Vince McMahon for. I really do. I think that really, those two signings may have been the last truly great thing that he did in his reign as the king of WWE. Now, I thought the women's War Games match was good. It was not great. It was very messy in parts. When I looked up from typing my notes to see Becky Lynch coming off the top of the cage through the table, I thought it was Rhea Ripley that she pinned. And not Dakota Kai. I thought it was Io and Rhea who were laid out on that table. And I thought Becky had pinned Rhea. And I got yelled at in the live chat. We had over 2,300 people at that point last night. You know, that early in the stream. 2,300 people telling me that it was Dakota trying to get my attention. And sure enough, when I went back to watch it, it was Dakota Kai that she pinned and not Rhea Ripley. Which makes a lot more sense than pinning Rhea. So that was my mistake. It was botchamania all around in this match and in the review. But I still would like to see Rhea Ripley get the shot at Bianca Belair. I am thinking that if it happens, I'm starting to think more and more it happens at the Royal Rumble and not WrestleMania, because I feel like they're going to be saving that Beth Phoenix match for WrestleMania. I think the WrestleMania match is probably going to be Beth and Rhea. I don't see them doing it earlier than that. So if that's the case, Rhea's not going to get the shot at Mania. She may get it a little bit earlier. Speaking of Rhea, I have to put her over here for this. The segment that they filmed, that they put up on their social media, and then I think they aired it on SmackDown, I think, Friday night, where Rhea and Dominic go to Rey Mysterio's house for Thanksgiving. Dom is bringing his goth girlfriend to dinner to introduce her to the family. All hell breaks loose. Poor Rey Mysterio in a walking boot. is pummeled in his own home. He is beaten senseless. I thought this is one of the greatest things that this company has done all year. I love this segment. And I can't wait to see what they do for Christmas and all the future holidays when they torment poor Rey Mysterio. But Dominic has been just killing it as a heel. You know, he has really just, personality-wise, he's been coming out of his shell. He's playing his part, I think, to perfection. And him joining the Judgment Day has actually been, it's been a good thing for the Judgment Day, I think, but it's been even better for him. And I compared it the other night, and I don't want people to twist this as if I'm saying that, oh, he's the next Rock. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, it reminds me of when The Rock came in, the big baby face, big smiling baby face. Everybody turned on him, die Rocky, die, right? All that stuff. When he came back from his injury, he joined the Nation of Domination. And Farouk basically, you know, brought him into the family, took him under his wing, and that's where he went heel, and he was able to start showing off more of his personality. And he got over that way. And I think this is a similar type of thing. The best thing that could have happened for Dominic was getting him away from Rey Mysterio. And giving him the chance, you know, not only to play off the other members of the Judgment Day, but I think being taken in under Finn Balor, who I think can probably teach him a whole bunch of things that he didn't know, not only about, you know, in-ring stuff, but probably just character development and just stuff that he's learned, because Balor's a vet. You know, Balor's been around for a long time now. He can kind of play that role for Dominic in the way that I'm sure Ron Simmons played for The Rock when he joined the Nation. I think it's been great for Dom. I'm sure they're going to circle back to WrestleMania. It'll be Rey against Dominic. That'll be the match. But I love that video. Now, we had AJ Styles beating Finn Balor. They went one-on-one. This was the first singles win on a pay-per-view for AJ Styles in more than 3 years. Since Crown Jewel in 2019, which is an insane stat. I thought they had a very good match. I thought it was a step below their first match from TLC in 2017. Karl Anderson confirmed this week that he will be defending his never open weight title against Hikuleo at the New Japan Tag League show on December 14th, Luke Gallows will be there with him. At the end of the video they posted on Instagram, AJ Styles is with them on the bus as they're traveling. And he gives the too sweet hand gesture. That would be very cool if Styles was allowed to go with them. Per Fightful, that date will not be the only date that Anderson works, as there are plans for him to work the Tokyo Dome for Wrestle Kingdom. He and Gallows had committed to it before they even left Impact. And I'm sure as part of their negotiations with WWE, they wanted to make sure that they would be able to fulfill those commitments. Otherwise, it would have... Look, if people thought that, okay, he's screwing over New Japan and this is not part of some, you know, work, whenever they post these promos where they're healing on New Japan, it's pretty obvious from the beginning they were working some kind of an angle here. If it wasn't, then Carl Anderson would have been stripped so fast of that never open weight title that this wouldn't have even been a conversation. So that should have been a telltale sign right there. But it looks like he'll be working the Dome. It'll be a very interesting Tokyo Dome show. Because you're going to have Carl Anderson and probably Luke Gallows at the Tokyo Dome, right? Two contracted WWE talents. You're going to have Kairi defending the brand new IWGP Women's Championship, right? As part of, that's the Stardom match. That'll be on the Wrestle Kingdom card. We already know Kenny Omega from AEW is going to be there challenging Will Ospreay. FTR going to be there defending their IWGP tag team titles. It's going to be quite the show. People talk about this forbidden door here. I mean, New Japan is opening the door for a lot of different people to show up on this show on January 4th. I have absolutely nothing positive to say about the SmackDown Women's Championship match from last night. Ronda Rousey against Shotzi was the worst women's championship match that I have ever seen on a WWE pay-per-view. And if you can find one that was worse, then this is still going to be one of the worst that I've ever seen. Rousey retains. Nobody believed that Shotzi had a realistic shot anyway. With or without Shayna Baszler out there. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about almost anybody Roman Reigns steps into the ring with these days, but at least that's an interesting story. There was nothing interesting about any of this. The match itself was fucking awful. And as far as where Ronda goes from here, you know, Raquel Rodriguez's storyline on SmackDown the other night was injured. Ronda slammed an equipment case lid on her arm, broke her arm or her elbow, whatever it was. So when she's healed up, you know, from her broken arm, probably in a matter of days, and she's back on TV, she's an obvious opponent for Ronda Rousey. Although that, to me, is not a pay-per-view title match, but they could do it on TV, maybe. So that's the obvious next opponent, but I'm looking ahead, right? I'm looking ahead to WrestleMania. Because Ronda Rousey's not dropping that women's championship before WrestleMania. So you look ahead to WrestleMania and you say, who is Ronda going to defend the title against in Mania? Or who is Ronda going to work with at WrestleMania? Becky Lynch would be an obvious name. They never did do the singles match between them. Becky now is a babyface. She's back just in time for WrestleMania. Ronda's the heel. They're in LA next year. If ever there was a time to do that match, it's now or never. You either do it at WrestleMania 39 or you don't do it at all. So I think that is a very distinct possibility. Shayna Baszler has been, in Ronda's corner now on TV. They finally put the two of them together on screen. Could they have Shayna Baszler be the one come WrestleMania to challenge her friend and challenge her for the SmackDown Women's Championship? Possibility, yes. Her name is on the list as well. We, however, had a little window into what our future may hold at the end of this match when Ronda was leaving. And she was mouthing things to the crowd, and she said, "This isn't a democracy, I'm the goddamn queen." Throwing the word queen out there sends shivers up my spine here, because this is not a match that anybody asked for. There's been talk that when Charlotte Flair comes back, maybe she'll challenge Bianca Belair. You know what? I think that could be an excellent match. The one match they had on Raw, was it last year, I think it was actually a great match. It would be a program that we haven't seen before. Nobody is asking for Ronda Rousey and Charlotte Flair to restart their feud that a lot of people didn't want to see in the first place. So I hope that that was not a tease of what's to come, but I also don't think that she said that for no reason. That may be a window into what we can expect there. But this was by far, I mean, not even close, this was by far the worst thing on the entire show last night. This had no business being on this pay-per-view. But there was an excellent triple threat match for the United States Championship. I thought Austin Theory, Seth Rollins, Bobby Lashley, they killed it. It was kind of a clever finish where Bobby speared Rollins as he was in the middle of an attempted Falcon Arrow. Theory falls on top of him, steals the pin. A little weird because they've been building Theory up as more of a serious threat and then he wins the title on a fluke, but that's, you know, such is the case in a triple threat match. It's all legal and things like that happen. The key now is going to be in the follow-up and how they book Austin Theory as the United States champion. Because they got the Money in the Bank briefcase off of him. They did it in just ridiculous fashion. But the briefcase is gone. Now they're trying to build him back up. They're trying to rebuild this kid. Putting the U.S. title on him is step one. I was surprised they took the title off Seth Rollins as quickly as they did. But I do think it paves the way now for there to be some drama at the end of the Royal Rumble match. If it comes down to Cody and Rollins, more drama than there would be if Rollins was still the U.S. champ. And we'll see where they go from here with Theory. The key for him is going to be in the booking. Now, Triple H hosted a post-show press conference last night and had a few things to say. I want to give a shout-out to Issa, NYC Demon Diva, getting that last question in. Triple H at the very end saw her in the front row, and I guess he saw that she was trying to ask a question the entire time. And Byron Saxton was not calling on her. He was calling a bunch of dudes. And so he kept things going and said, can we let the young lady ask a question? And she asked him a question about doing more international events with some of the success they've had doing them recently. Obviously, Clash at the Castle in Cardiff. They have their Saudi Arabia shows. Where else might they be doing shows? And I saw that little wink that he gave her when he mentioned Puerto Rico and then said, stay tuned. I saw that. He said that this was the highest grossing Survivor Series of all time and the most viewed. I don't know how they calculate these things now because Peacock subscriptions, I know they've skyrocketed by something like 70% since the start of the year. I think they have over 15 million subscribers now. I mean, all of these streaming services, you know, pale in comparison to Disney Plus, which I think has like hundreds of millions of subs or something ridiculous like that. But I think it's been about a 70% jump since the beginning of the year for Peacock. So I don't know if they're measuring the exact number of people who are watching or if they're just basically saying, we're streaming on a service that has 15 million subs now. So every show going forward is going to be our highest viewed event. We'll see if they say the same thing about the Royal Rumble. I guarantee you they will. They'll say this is the highest viewed Royal Rumble in history. They may just be doing that for every single show now going forward. On making War Games an annual event at Survivor Series, this is what Triple H had to say. He said, we'll see. It worked out incredibly well tonight, but we'll see how it goes. We are in the process of looking at the year-to-year schedule as to where things go, but I feel positive about it. I honestly, having seen these matches last night, it might be better if they did one War Games match each year. I would prefer to see one. One War Games match each year instead of two. And you reserve it for whatever the best story is at that time. If they have a good story like they did last night, they had a great story, going on with the men, right? Like they did with the Bloodline, then you go with the men. If the better story that year is with the women, then you do a women's War Games. And with the men, maybe instead, if there's an off year where you're not doing a men's War Games, you do a classic Survivor Series elimination match instead. That's my two cents on how I think they should handle it. And if they insist on filling these rings up with weapons, which was, I mean, both War Games matches last night, it was like a carbon copy of each other. Where guys and girls, they're coming down, they're pulling shit out from under the ring, tables, chairs, kendo sticks, right? It's the same shit over and over again. If they insist on doing this and filling the rings up with weapons, then they should just attach them to the sides of the cage inside. Instead of everybody who comes down having to go underneath the ring and pull this out and pull that out and fit it through the door. All while their partners are left to die in the ring getting their asses handed to them. There was a moment in the women's War Games match, Mia Yim came out and her team is just having their asses kicked. And instead of going in there and helping her team, right, and increasing the numbers for her team, she decides, I'm going to go furniture shopping. Like she's at fucking Raymore and Flanagan, and she's under the ring and she's pulling out garbage cans. She can't even get them through the door. They keep falling out. One garbage can, two garbage can, three. Her team is being killed in this rant. It was ridiculous. It was so stupid. Just have them already in the ring. If that's what you're going to do, just do it that way. So he was also asked about reports of them moving away from some of the gimmick pay-per-views that they do, like Hell in a Cell and Money in the Bank. If you remember, there was a report many weeks ago from WrestleVotes saying that Triple H considers the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view concept to be dead. which it has needed to be for many years now. The worst thing that ever happened to Hell in a Cell was turning it into an annual event. This is what Triple H had to say. Hell in a Cell. There was a feeling that Hell in a Cell is one of those things that it's this giant blow-off. If you're going to call somebody out at the end of something, you can challenge them to Hell in a Cell. I hear the speculation among fans about Hell in a Cell, Money in the Bank, Elimination Chamber, that maybe those things should go away. Some of that, I hear. Hell in a Cell, I hear it. I had a highlight of my career, Foley and I, calling each other out for Hell in a Cell. When you get into, though, I challenge you to Elimination Chamber with five other guys. It doesn't work. Same thing, I challenge you to Money in the Bank. There's a difference there. I think we have to reevaluate all of that. We have to look at that. And it's really looking at the overall calendar and saying, what is the best place to put this? What is the best way to entertain our fans? It is no different than looking at a show and saying, this match has to deliver, but it can't take away from the rest of the show. It's the whole arcing story of what we are doing right now. And then it's the whole year of what we put out. There are so many layers to what we do that you have to keep in mind all of those, and we will, moving forward. It's up in the air, but it is something that we think about. All right, so he started to lose me there a little bit, talking about arcs and layers. If you read between the lines, he did not deny the report about Hell in a Cell. He could have come right out and said that, I don't know where that came from, you know, we're discussing it, or I don't know where that came from, that's not true. He did not deny it. I think it's dead. I think Hell in a Cell as a pay-per-view is dead. You heard him right there say a lot of the stuff that I've said. He's talking about how Hell in a Cell should be saved as the blow-off for a big feud between two people. That's exactly what it should be. There's been talk of Money in the Bank possibly going back to being a feature of WrestleMania. Maybe a women's match on one night, a men's match on the next. You have two nights of WrestleMania now. I think that works as an attraction for WrestleMania. Elimination Chamber should still be its own show. Like War Games at Survivor Series. I think you can leave that one alone, especially if it has implications for WrestleMania. It's not as necessary this year since they unified the titles, but assuming that they will be de-unified at some point, I don't think keeping Elimination Chamber as its own pay-per-view is a problem. And I feel the same way about War Games. Or rather, I feel the same way about Elimination Chamber that I do about War Games, in that I don't think there needs to be a men's and a women's Elimination Chamber match every single year. I think they can switch off depending on where it makes more sense to do it in a given year. Maybe do what they did in 2020, where they had a tag team chamber match, and then a women's chamber is what headlined the pay-per-view. They had no singles chamber for the men that year. But I don't know that it has to be, okay, we need one for the men and one for the women every single year. I think you switch off depending on where it makes the most sense to be doing it. Now, Triple H posted a tweet before Survivor Series last night that got some people talking. He shared a video that WWE had put together. It was a little, like, 10-second compilation video. Maybe not even 10 seconds. It might have been, like, 6 seconds. Of William Regal, over the years, saying the words, War Games! And he shared the video because he just felt like, you know, you can't have a War Games show without having William Regal saying War Games. This was basically his way of saying, wouldn't it be great to hear Regal back calling, you know, for War Games again on TV? He wants his buddy back. He wants his buddy back. These guys have been tight going back to their days together in WCW. It's why he had Regal working for him as one of his right-hand men in NXT, at the Performance Center. One of the dumbest moves by Vince McMahon, by that whole regime. You know, I just complimented him on re-signing Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. On the flip side of that, one of the absolute dumbest things that they did in a long line of dumb moves was firing William Regal. Dave Meltzer said on Observer Radio that Regal has months left on his AEW contract. He said he was told a date. He was given a date. He didn't, you know, he didn't say by who, obviously, but he said he was given a date. But he didn't want to give the date to us because it could be wrong. But it's still months away. He was told a date, but that date could be wrong, and so he doesn't want to share what that date is. Thanks, Dave. February is going to be 1 year since William Regal showed up at Revolution. It's kind of an important point to know whether he has a one-year deal or if he has a two-year deal or a three-year deal, because that's going to dictate whether or not he goes back to WWE in a few months. You know, so we don't know exactly how long he has left on his deal, other than it's several months, according to Dave Meltzer. But if Regal is going to be a free agent soon, I absolutely think he will end up back in WWE. And a year from now, when we're back here talking about War Games again at Survivor Series, we're going to have William Regal on television screaming the words War Games on TV. But it all depends on how much longer he's going to be under contract for. If it is a year or longer, then obviously that's not going to happen. I don't see Tony Khan just letting him walk, you know, right back into WWE. But right now there's a lot of talk about exactly how long is left on his deal. Now, there was no Bray Wyatt match on the card last night. The World Cup Finals for SmackDown, they're saving that for SmackDown in Buffalo, I believe, this Friday. It's going to be Ricochet against Santos Escobar. It's Lucha Underground reincarnated in WWE form. We're going to get Prince Puma against King Cuerno on SmackDown this Friday. But one just quick thought, one quick note on the booking of this World Cup tournament. You know, they have said that the winner of the World Cup is going to, down the road at some point, get a future Intercontinental Championship match with Gunther. And they've taken steps over the last couple of weeks to build interest in a Braun Strowman Gunther match. They had Gunther running away from him multiple times, which was ridiculous a few weeks ago, so fucking dumb. Again this week, Imperium came out, caused a distraction that led to Braun being pinned by Ricochet, so Braun is out of the World Cup. It's either going to be Ricochet getting a championship match against Gunther, or it's going to be Santos Escobar. And I think this tournament should have been, from day one, a vehicle to help get Santos Escobar over and give him, you know, a big win and kind of get him rolling on SmackDown. But I just cannot imagine them doing Escobar against Gunther for the Intercontinental title, which tells me that Ricochet is probably going over here. But the whole point is, if this tournament is designed for the winner to get an Intercontinental Championship match, you want to build to an Intercontinental title match people want to see. Everything that they have done in the last couple of weeks has run counter to that, because the match they have been building that people are going to want to see, and really the biggest possible match they could do right now for that title, is Gunther against Braun Strowman. And Braun Strowman is out of the tournament. We know we're going to get that match at some point, maybe the Royal Rumble. We know that match is coming. So no matter who wins this tournament, we're going to get an Intercontinental title match that nobody really wants to see. Or if you want to see it, the match people really want to see that has been communicated to us is the real big deal is the match between the two big guys. So again, I think they've already, you know, cut the nuts off whoever wins this tournament. And the booking here has just been very, very strange and very counterproductive, I think, to what they're trying to do. Why even attach that stipulation at all? Why not just have a World Cup tournament without saying that the winner gets an Intercontinental title match? Or at least wait until after the tournament is over to start building interest in seeing Braun Strowman get the match, when we already know he's not getting it, so who cares? Who cares who wins? What does it really matter? Let's talk about Randy Orton, because we've got some news on him. We have an update. We have an update on Randy Orton, and it is not good. In fact, it is fair to ask the question if we will ever see Randy Orton back in the ring again. Now, Randy Orton has not wrestled a match since the May 20th episode of SmackDown, where he and Matt Riddle lost the Raw Tag Team titles to the Usos in a unification match. He had been dealing with a bad back for a while. It took everything he had just to get through that one match. He had been working through the injury for some time, and it just got progressively worse. And there were plans at one point for Randy Orton to challenge Roman Reigns at SummerSlam this year. That obviously never happened. WWE was very concerned that he might require surgery, which would have sidelined him for the rest of the year. He never had the surgery, but he was trying to rehab the injury with rest. That did not work. And according to a report from Fightful Select, Orton underwent fusion surgery on his lower back recently. Dave Meltzer says the date of the surgery was November 14th, so 2 weeks ago. That was the same day that his wife posted a photo on Instagram of him in the hospital, either going into or coming out of an operation of some kind. So any hope of Randy Orton being back in time for the Royal Rumble or being back in time for WrestleMania is out the window. But it's more serious than that. I mean, that's major surgery to have. Now, I personally don't think that we have seen the last of Randy Orton in a wrestling ring, but this could be a career-ending injury. And if it's not career-ending, what kind of career is he going to have now going forward? I think his full-time days are over. Maybe he only wrestles the occasional big match here and there. I don't even think he knows the answer to that yet. He only just went under the knife. He doesn't know how he's going to feel in 6 months or a year. But it's tough, you know, when you are someone whose signature move, the move that you're known for, requires you to take a back bump every time you hit it. I mean, it's such an easy move. You can hit it on anyone, no matter how big they are. But you don't really stop and think about the toll that that takes night in and night out on your lower back. Orton got so much out of doing so little in the ring. You know, he works smart, as I've heard wrestlers say. He works smart. He worked a safe style, but he's still out there taking bumps for 20 years and landing on his back with that RKO every single night. Look at Hulk Hogan. Barely ever left his feet. The man didn't exactly work strong style. But he was dropping that leg every single night, 280 pounds landing on his ass and his spine. Sometimes 400 days a year with the time zone difference between Japan and the States. That's according to the Hulkster himself. 10 back surgeries later, the man can barely walk. He's all crippled up. Still keeps his upper body in great shape, but he's paying the price for all those leg drops and all those bumps. You can be the safest, lightest worker in the world, never come off the top rope, never do a dive, never worked a hardcore style like Mick Foley, and still end up getting your knees replaced, your hips replaced, your spine or your back fused. Because the human body was not built to take the kind of abuse that pro wrestlers take. Over a 20 or 30 year career, eventually it catches up with you. Someone like Ric Flair, 73 years old, the man is a freak of nature. He broke his back in a plane crash over 40 years ago, and then went on to have the kind of career that he did. Think of how many thousands of hours that he has logged inside the ring. He moves around better than most wrestlers his age. Chris Jericho is 50. He's still out there taking bumps and moving around really well. The only serious injury he's ever had in his 30-plus years was a broken arm, and that happened in Smoky Mountain in 1994. You know, people like him, people like Kane, somehow they've managed to avoid any real significant injuries, you know, and Kane's a big guy. You think on a big guy like that, the knees are the first thing to go. Look at the kind of career that Kane had. He had like one torn tricep or bicep or something in 2002. That's the only major injury I can think of him ever having. So there are exceptions. But Randy Orton is paying a price that many wrestlers unfortunately pay in their careers, and it comes after one of the hottest runs of his entire career, teaming with Riddle and doing the RK-Bro stuff. That RK-Bro run is going to go down as one of Randy Orton's best. I don't put it above the Legend Killer stuff that he did, but it's up there. Riddle brought out a side of Randy Orton that we have never seen before. Orton looked like he was having the time of his life out there, and he's admitted that. He has said as much. RK-Bro was the hottest thing on Monday Night Raw, and I think it did just as much good for Matt Riddle as it did for Randy Orton, because it showed Vince McMahon that this guy can get over and he can hang at a main event level. Now that his feud with Seth Rollins is over, Riddle, yeah, he won the finale in the fight pit, but Rollins is the one who, up until last night, was holding a championship. Seth Rollins was the one with a match at Survivor Series last night. Did you see Matt Riddle on the card last night? Because I didn't. Now he's out there banging bongos on TV and tagging with Elias. Believe me, nobody is more disappointed about this Randy Orton news than Matt Riddle. It was only back in April that Orton celebrated 20 years in WWE. You know, he was never the flashiest guy. He was never the most exciting to watch, but his shit always looked good. He was smooth in the ring. His promos, I don't think, were the greatest, but Orton was a top guy for a good chunk of those 20 years. But he was never the guy, because he got big at the same time that John Cena got big, and John Cena is the one who they went with. Cena was the one they trusted. Orton was more polished in the ring than Cena was, but Cena was the superstar they were looking for. Orton always felt like he was playing second fiddle with, you know, maybe one or two exceptions. That period where he was punting everybody in the skull, remember he punted Vince McMahon in the head? He gave Stephanie an RKO. He kissed Stephanie while Triple H was cuffed to the ropes and couldn't do anything but watch. There was a period the year after that also, after the Legacy split, where Orton, the fans basically turned him babyface, and he felt like the biggest star in the business for a few months. So there were periods like that if you look back on his career, but there was never any Randy Orton era like you would have with other big names. He's held every championship, every major accolade there is to hold. It's not like there's anything left that he absolutely has to do. But when I talked about him in April, I pointed out, you know, he's only 42, so he still has many more years left to go. That was before I knew just how bad his back was. And I had pitched the idea of doing John Cena against Randy Orton for the first time ever at a WrestleMania. Do it at WrestleMania 40 in 2024. Cena has 16 world titles. He's only one away from breaking Ric Flair's phony record. Randy Orton is at 14. You could have gotten Orton a little bit closer, and then you could have had a battle for number 17 at WrestleMania one last time between John Cena and Randy Orton. That would have been an attraction. I always thought there was a better chance that Orton would get there before Cena does. That looks a lot less likely now. But if Randy Orton decided to hang it up after this, if he feels like I'm done, I can't go anymore, or the doctors say you really shouldn't get back in the ring, the guy's already a Hall of Famer. He's not a Mount Rushmore guy for me, but he has already cemented his legacy. He doesn't have anything left to prove. WrestleMania could be coming to Music City, USA for the first time in 2027. This is according to a story in the Tennessean newspaper. It says, WrestleMania is headed to Nashville, provided a proposed enclosed stadium is built in the next 5 years. And then they have this guy's name here, Butch Spiridon, CEO of the Nashville Convention and Visitors Corporation, had spoken in the past with World Wrestling Entertainment about hosting WrestleMania. When Mayor John Cooper and the Tennessee Titans delivered the draft terms for the enclosed proposed stadium to the Nashville Council in October, those talks ramped up and Spiridon received a verbal commitment from WWE to host the 2027 WrestleMania with the provision that the stadium gets built. The minute the mayor's office and the Titans released the stadium term sheet, he said, we started looking for opportunities. WWE had an incredible experience at Nissan Stadium this past summer. That was for SummerSlam. And we started talking. WrestleMania is considered the number six top sports event brand in the world, and we are grateful for their confidence and belief in Nashville. Now, when asked for comment, WWE issued the following statement. They said, Nashville has exploded as a cultural center in the United States and as the land of opportunity. WWE looks forward to hosting many events in partnership with the great city of Nashville at the proposed enclosed stadium. The proposal to build a $2.1 billion enclosed stadium will be voted on by the Metro Council. Spiridon recently met with the council to report the deal with WrestleMania was in place. Well, this will make the folks in Vancouver very happy. I know they're still waiting for their WrestleMania. Verbal commitments don't necessarily mean anything. I mean, just ask the folks in Minnesota. 7 years ago, the VP of Public Affairs for the Minnesota Vikings was talking about their new billion-dollar stadium that was being built at the time. That's U.S. Bank Stadium. And he let it slip that WrestleMania was coming. He was talking about having already secured the Super Bowl in 2018, the NCAA Final Four in 2019. And then he made the comment. He says, you know, we have WrestleMania coming. WrestleMania is still waiting to come to Minnesota. WrestleMania is coming more than Veer did. WWE at the time put out a statement after he leaked that, saying that Minneapolis had expressed an interest in hosting a future WrestleMania, but that locations for future WrestleManias had not yet been announced. Kind of similar to the statement that they put out here, and WrestleMania still hasn't been announced for U.S. Bank Stadium all these years later. Let me take a moment here to let you all know that today's episode is sponsored by our friends at BetterHelp Online Therapy. You know, there's a lot of times in my life where I wish I had a user manual to guide me on what I should be doing. Life doesn't work that way. And when it's not working for you, believe me, it's normal to feel stuck. Therapists are trained to help you try to get to the root of what is causing whatever emotions that you may be dealing with and teach you how to cope, which makes therapy the next best thing to a step-by-step how-to in the game of life. Not the board game, although I have played that too when I was a kid. I wasn't very good at it. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It's convenient, secure, and accessible from anywhere, 100% online. Therapy can help you learn valuable skills to overcome the challenges that you're dealing with and help you deal with trauma in your life. You don't want to let these things fester. It's better to tackle these problems now so that you're better off later. This is why I think BetterHelp is a great option for so many people. So many of you have written into the show telling me that you have never even heard of BetterHelp until I started mentioning it, and you've tried it, and you've had positive experiences with it, which is what I love to hear. BetterHelp is the world's largest therapy service and has all the benefits of in-person therapy, plus it's more affordable, more convenient, and more accessible. No more driving to someone's office, trying to find parking, sitting in a waiting room for an hour. All you have to do is fill out a short questionnaire to match with a therapist, and if things for whatever reason aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. If you're feeling stuck, get unstuck with BetterHelp. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. Switching over to AEW. AEW was in Chicago on Wednesday night for the first Dynamite after Full Gear. And you knew coming in that the Elite were walking into the Lion's Den. They were walking into Punk Country. Kenny Omega knew it. The Young Bucks knew it. And they planned accordingly. Now, I saw Brian Alvarez claim the other day that they didn't plan the things that they did on Wednesday. I don't believe that for a second. They knew exactly what they were doing. They worked their match with Death Triangle as the heels, match number 2 in their best of 7 series for the Trios titles. And people lost their minds over it. Part of the reason that they did is because in an interview with Sports Illustrated that I think dropped the day before, Kenny Omega had the following to say about the whole brawl out thing and the situation with CM Punk. This is the closest comment that any of these guys have made about Punk or the incident since it happened. He said, "There are things that nobody can talk about, so I would encourage people to let it go. It doesn't change that we want a team effort in AEW. I don't even mean implicitly myself and my opponent. It also means the referee, the fans, the people who set up the ring, everyone. Even a technical error can ruin the memory of a match. I can refer back to the exploding barbed wire death match. So I encourage people to move away from it because there is no information to be released. Though I cannot talk about it, I do want the fans to know that I still want the best for pro wrestling. The day after the pay-per-view, I was absolutely devastated by the loss of Jason David Frank. He's one of my childhood heroes. That evening, there was a mass shooting at an LGBTQ club where 5 people died. It's absolutely terrible. After such tragedy, it puts everything in perspective. This isn't Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks against CM Punk. It's people trying to show off their craft. You can boo Kenny Omega, you can boo the Young Bucks or CM Punk, but I hope people don't forget that we are human beings struggling to show our art." Oh my God. Every time I hear Omega talk about his art, I want to gag. That being said, I had no issue with him and the Young Bucks trolling all the CM Punk fans on Wednesday night. They knew they would be booed. They knew they would be showered by Punk chants and Fuck the Elite chants. So they leaned into it. They made the most of it. They had fun with it. Matt Jackson tried a buckshot lariat. He landed on his ass, just like Punk did at Double or Nothing. Omega, he bit Pac on the forearm, the same way that Omega allegedly got bit on the arm by Nosferatu, Ace Steel. Omega was the one who got bit in that whole mess. He was the one with bite marks on his arm. So he poked fun at it by biting Pac. And I sat here and I laughed my ass off. I was sports entertained. Then later on, he used the go to sleep, which he went on Twitter later on and credited Kenta for. And I mean, it is Kenta's move. I mean, Punk just borrowed it. So that got a nice rise out of the crowd. And when it was over, Penta used the ball peen hammer on Matt Jackson. He pinned him to win the match. and put Death Triangle up 2-0 in the series. Two straight losses for the Elite. They played off the crowd reaction. They had the crowd loud for the entire match, and then they lost. Much to the delight of the Chicago faithful. I thought it was great. I saw it for what it was, as a one-week thing to make the most of the situation that was presented to them. If this was any other city, if they were anywhere but Chicago on Wednesday, we wouldn't have seen any of these antics. I don't believe. It's not very often that you get a crowd as rabid as what they had for that match on Wednesday. I don't expect this to become a weekly occurrence where they go around trolling CM Punk on television. Unless CM Punk is coming back to AEW. I can see how people would watch that and think that, oh, well, Punk has to be. He has to be coming back now. I mean, come on. You can't, this doesn't make any sense unless Punk is not coming back. They must have worked something out with all the parties involved. They must have smoothed things over. And when Punk is all healed up from his injury, they're going to make some money off what happened. We're going to get CM Punk against Kenny Omega. We're going to get CM Punk teaming with FTR against Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks, maybe for the Trios belts. I don't see it. I still don't think CM Punk is wrestling again for AEW. But anything's possible. Tony Khan has been silent on the status of CM Punk, possibly because they're still trying to work out what future, if any, he even has in the company. Now, I don't watch BTE, so I did not see their new episode where I guess they aired the fuck CM Punk chants from Full Gear. I didn't see it. I don't know what the context behind it was. If they just aired it to make fun of him, then yes, that sounds very petty. And if you think that Kenny Omega is a hypocrite for telling Sports Illustrated that he wishes people would just move on from the Punk stuff and then he turns around and does what he did on Wednesday, if you think that makes him a hypocrite, I wouldn't disagree with you. Although I look at that, again, as more about... I looked at that as more about people asking them questions about the incident and trying to get answers from them about what happened when they can't answer those questions. You know, maybe they signed some kind of legal document or confidentiality agreement or something. So when he made that comment in the interview in Sports Illustrated, that's how I read that. Like, people need to move on. They have to stop asking questions because we're not going to be able to answer them. You know, he was saying, just move on. We can't talk about it. But yes, the timing of those comments, I think they came out the day before. And then what he did on Dynamite, those two things seem to conflict with each other. So they're hypocrites. But that doesn't make what they did in the match any less entertaining to me. And if CM Punk were to show up on Monday Night Raw in 6 months and mock the Young Bucks by doing their stupid flex pose, I would like to think that I have enough of a sense of humor that I would laugh at that too. I mean, my God, there are times to get upset about certain things. This was not one of those times. I'm glad they didn't just ignore the crowd. They embraced it. That's like something they would teach you in WWE. Ignore the crowd. You have a job out there. We want you to act a certain way. We want you to behave a certain way. Pretend the crowd isn't there. Don't even make eye contact with the crowd. That's not pro wrestling. Pro wrestling is all about the crowd. You're feeding off the crowd. The crowd is the third man. The crowd dictates who's over and who's not. Play into it. That's what they did on Wednesday. I didn't have an issue with it. They embraced it. They embraced the reaction. They set up Death Triangle to be the clear baby faces in the match, even though they've been hitting people in the head with hammers. But those are wrestling fans for you. I mean, Hulk Hogan hit The Rock in the head with a hammer and tried to murder him with a semi-truck, and he was cheered at WrestleMania. He was cheered like the Beatles coming to America for the first time, stepping off the airplane. I fully expect this series to go the full 7 matches, with the Elite winning back the Trios titles when it's all said and done, because I think that was always the goal, was to get the belts back on the Elite and just pick up where they were going when they first won them back at All Out. If CM Punk is not coming back to AEW and the Elite guys continue to take little digs at CM Punk outside of Chicago, that I would take issue with. Especially as EVPs in the company. I've made it very clear. I know people have selective hearing. You should see the comments I got. Just because I like that match on Wednesday, oh my God, the comments I got about, oh, you know, you're in the tank for the Elite. You're so biased for the Elite. Why do you hate CM Punk so much? It's so clear that you hate CM Punk. You should see the comments I got this week. Of course, people conveniently forget the fact that when they accuse me of this and they say, well, you know, based on what you say, CM Punk should be fired from AEW and never hired by WWE, and the Elite should get off scot-free and nothing should happen to the Elite, even though I said it then and I'll say it again now. I don't believe that any of the Elite guys should be executive vice presidents in this company. I've made that very clear. I know people like to have selective hearing, right? Maybe one ear works, the other one doesn't. Maybe it's got a lot of wax buildup in there, so I'll say it again. For all the idiots who can't hear me the first time, I will happily repeat myself and say it again. Maybe I'll even talk a little bit slower, just to make sure that you actually understand what it is that I'm saying. If it were up to me, Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks would no longer have those EVP titles. I said it 2 months ago, I still feel the same way now. Those trios titles would not have been the only titles that I would have stripped from them. Tony Khan didn't do that. Maybe because there wasn't enough there to justify him doing that. Maybe there wasn't enough there to prove that they were the ones leaking stuff about CM Punk. Maybe it's a legal issue. Without cause, he can't take their titles away. I don't know. I don't know how their contracts are made up or what the fine print says. There's a lot that we still don't know about what happened that night. It's very frustrating. There's still no evidence there was even any investigation to begin with. There probably was, but I'm saying there's no evidence that there was an investigation. We just have to take their word for it. We have to take them at face value. But regardless of who threw what and who got bit and who did this and who did that, I think it creates the potential for too much conflict when you have three of your top talents in your promotion pulling double duty as executives in that same company. Executives who may be able to exert a certain level of influence over other talents in that company. They see what happened with CM Punk and how nothing happened, seemingly nothing happened to the Elite. And if they ever have problems with any of those three guys, they may feel like they can't come forward and say anything about it. They can't do anything to address it out of fear that it could cost them their job. I think it would make more sense to keep the talent and the executive types separate. You want to be an executive? Fine. Retire. Retire and then you can be in the office. You want to wrestle? Then you're not going to be an executive. You're not going to have an executive title. You're not going to have an executive office. You're not going to get the employee benefits. Pick one or the other. Evidently, Tony Khan doesn't feel the same way. So they had their fun in Chicago. They got it out of their system. It made the atmosphere for the match more fun. But that shit can't continue because at that point, there really is no good defense for it. On Dynamite Wednesday night, in addition to the trios match, we had MJF absent from the show. Apparently he was off filming for his movie, his role in the Iron Claw movie. But William Regal was there. Didn't offer much of an explanation for turning on Jon Moxley at Full Gear. He did mention an email. He mentioned that MJF will explain everything on Dynamite this coming Wednesday. We had a tense confrontation in the ring with Regal and Mox. Mox was being held back by Bryan Danielson, who was asking him as a favor not to beat up William Regal because of how important Regal has been to him in his career. And Moxley told Regal to get lost and keep walking, and Regal went. He walked to the back, and who knows, he may end up walking all the way back to the arms of Triple H and WWE before long. But I thought it was actually a great opening segment, even though I was hoping that we would get that MJF segment, but if he couldn't be there, then what are you going to do? Ricky Starks beat Ethan Page in the finals of the world title eliminator. He will be going to Winter Is Coming next month to challenge MJF for the AEW World Championship, which is absolutely the right move to have absolute Ricky Starks heading to the finals. And that's going to be the biggest match of his life up to this point. And I think it could be, even though he won't win, I think it could be a way to launch Ricky Starks to that next level in this company as somebody who is looked at as more of a major player than he is now. You know, MJF and Ricky Starks could be one of those feuds that we look back on 2-3 years from now as one of the, you know, kind of all-time great rivalries in AEW. This could be the first taste of what's to come between these two. Chris Jericho had an excellent main event, retaining the Ring of Honor World Championship over Tomohiro Ishii of New Japan Pro Wrestling. And as I said on the stream on Wednesday night, Jericho has had some bangers in the last few months since winning that ROH title with Claudio, with Bandido, with Dalton Castle. We had the four-way at Full Gear. That was excellent. This week again with Ishii. Now at Final Battle, we know that it's going to be Chris Jericho wrestling Claudio Castagnoli again. This time, if Claudio loses, he has to join the Jericho Appreciation Society. As if they don't have enough members as it is, right? Jericho, Hager, Guevara, Garcia, Parker, Menard, Anna Jay, Ty Mello. We don't need any more members. I would rather Claudio just win the belt back. And Thunder Rosa is no longer the AEW Women's Champion. She did not appear live on the show, but we were told by Renee that in discussing things with Tony Khan, Thunder Rosa agreed to relinquish the AEW Women's Championship because they still don't know exactly when she's going to be back. It could be January, it could be February, and they don't want to drag this out anymore. So she agreed to relinquish the title retroactively so that Tony Storm's run will now count as an official AEW Women's title run, not an interim one. Jamie Hayter, of course, beat her for the championship at Full Gear, which means Jamie Hayter is now officially the undisputed, full-blown AEW Women's Champion. And the crowd reaction to the announcement that Thunder Rosa was relinquishing the championship got a big pop from the crowd. And I think part of it also is just people are tired of the interim nonsense, and they like Jamie Hayter. They like hearing that Jamie Hayter is now officially the AEW Women's Champion, but I'm sure that had to sting a little bit if you're Thunder Rosa watching that from home. And people are talking about how, okay, Thunder Rosa is no longer the champion. And they go, yay, or a big pop. And she's at home dealing with this injury. I'm sure that wasn't a great feeling for her. But Toni Storm was on Rampage on Friday night, which I did watch. It was a quick backstage interview. They were sitting down in the back. I think they were sitting on some crates or something. And Toni Storm had two black eyes, because I think she may have gotten her nose broken at the pay-per-view. And when that happens, you end up with black eyes. So she looked like she was in a fucking fight. And she was talking about how she's actually happy for Jamie. They used to be friends, and so she's very happy for her. But she pointed out that, yet again, she needed help from Britt and Rebel. She didn't win the match on her own. She said, I broke my face losing this championship. I'll break my face again to win the belt back if that's what I have to do. I thought it was a really good promo, the best promo I've seen out of Toni Storm since coming to AEW. And Colt Cabana, on his Art of Wrestling podcast, talked about how he nearly died during his Dynamite match a few weeks ago against Chris Jericho. That was the match for the Ring of Honor World title. He said, a couple of weeks ago, I wrestled Chris Jericho. I wanted to share the story of how I almost died wrestling him. I'm not telling this story to make an excuse. Nobody would have known. Everyone complimented me on my match, and I'm appreciative for that. It's a fun story, and maybe in 20 years I'll laugh about it, but in the moment, I did not laugh. Now, Cabana said that he usually wears normal socks as part of his outfit, but for this match, he bought compression socks. I bought a pair of compression socks once to try to get rid of some swelling that I still get in my left foot after I fucked my knee up 4 years ago, and I will never wear them again. They basically cut off the circulation to my feet. I don't know how anybody could possibly be comfortable wearing these things. But he said, as I go to wrestle Jericho, I put on my compression socks, my knee pads, and my boots. What I don't realize is that I have essentially made a tourniquet in the bottom half of my body. My blood flow is perfect, so what I did was restrict everything. I remember vividly thinking, I can't feel my legs. I guess it's just the nerves. It's nerves and anxiety. But it was also compression socks. And he said that this caused him to have high blood pressure and low oxygen, but he gutted his way through the match. When he got to the back and he went to the trainer's room, he couldn't move. And he started having trouble breathing. He had a bad headache. He said the eyes of the trainers were like, what? When they found out that he was wearing compression socks. They asked him to lay back for the next couple of hours. They put ice all over his body. And he said he was educated as to why you should not professionally wrestle in front of 10,000 people and almost a million people at home in compression socks. Are we sure that CM Punk in his time off did not start selling his own brand of compression socks to try to kill Colt Cabana? Because I totally think he may have tried to kill Colt Cabana. Man, the rain is coming down like you wouldn't believe. I can hear it right outside my window. So through the raindrops, we move on here. Now back in March, I talked about the Cain Velasquez story, the former UFC heavyweight champion, one-time WWE star. They signed him to a contract. He wrestled exactly one match on television in Saudi Arabia against Brock Lesnar, and he was never seen again. They released him a few months later due to budget cuts, right? The budget cuts, and so he was gone. He was charged with attempted murder for trying to kill the man accused of molesting his four-year-old son at a home daycare center. This happened earlier this year. There was an 11-mile-long high-speed chase where Cain fired multiple rounds from a handgun into the car, a moving car that was carrying this person. Cain missed the target. He struck the man's stepfather instead. He was arrested. He was denied bail. He's been locked up ever since. He's facing a minimum of 20 years behind bars. And with the other charges that he's facing, he could very well be looking at spending the rest of his life inside of a prison cell. He recklessly put other people's lives at risk by doing what he did. And I can completely understand him feeling the way that he did and wanting to kill the guy. I probably would have felt the same way if it was my child. But having those thoughts and acting on them are two different things. And look, if you're going to do something like that, at least be smarter not to put other people's lives at risk. So he made a huge error in judgment. And the reality is you got to pay some kind of a penalty for that. I just don't see any way out of this for him. Well, Cain was recently granted bail. He's out on $1 million bail. So he's been at home under house confinement with his family. And on Tuesday, a judge in Santa Clara County, out in California, ruled that Velasquez will be allowed to travel, as per his request, to Tempe, Arizona to take part in the upcoming Lucha Libre AAA show taking place next Saturday. The judge ruled that his house confinement restrictions will be temporarily waived. He will have his GPS monitor removed, but he will also need to have a police escort with him. So this is the update. After the defense attorney and district attorney representative on Monday were heard by the judge, on Tuesday, Judge Arthur Bocanegra ruled that Velasquez will be allowed to partake in the event without GPS monitoring, despite the district attorney's office's objection. Easy for me to say. He will leave December 1st, and he will return December 4th. As a result of his monitoring device being removed for the duration of this trip, the judge ruled that Velasquez must hire a police officer for work detail and absorb the cost. So he needs a police escort, but he has to pay for it. He has to go find it himself. This is not Cain's first time wrestling for AAA. He has wrestled for them before. All three times he's wrestled in six-man tags, the last one being almost a year ago to the day of this show next weekend. And on the one hand, again, I can sympathize with what the man did. On the other, he fired a loaded gun into a moving car and tried to murder someone. And if this was anyone else, I wonder if this judge would have waived their restrictions to let them professionally wrestle. Probably not. This is the first AAA show in the U.S. since their New York City show 3 years ago at the over at the Hulu Theater in Madison Square Garden. That show did not do very well at all. Tickets are said to not be selling well for this show either, so they really wanted Cain on the show to try to boost ticket sales. They should just go all the way with this and just have him, give him the 2003 Cain entrance, where they lead him to the ring in chains, right? Maybe dress him up in the orange jumpsuit like Nails used to wear. If there was a legal way to get him in the ring with the man he accused of molesting his son, just 5 minutes alone with this guy in his bare hands, I would buy a ticket and fly myself out to Arizona to see that. Let me talk about this NXT show from Tuesday night. Let me talk to you. There were positives. NXT is not what it used to be. NXT is largely a terrible show, but there were positives. Wesley and Carmelo Hayes had a great main event for the North American Championship. It was a great showcase for two men who, with any luck, we will be seeing a lot more of on Raw or SmackDown next year. Wesley, I could absolutely see him as a future Intercontinental or United States champion. He's a Ricochet-type star, and I think he will be treated better under Triple H than he would have been under Vince McMahon. Under Vince McMahon, he would have zero chance of even making the main roster. But Wesley is not a future WWE champion. Wesley is not a future Universal champion. Carmelo Hayes can be a future world champion, and I'm not even talking just main roster. They had Carmelo Hayes lose clean in the middle of the ring and put over Wesley. But that does not mean that he is on his way up to the main roster just yet. I think he's ready. He's been ready. They also don't have to rush it, though, because there's one match we still have not gotten, which is Carmelo Hayes challenging Bron Breakker for the NXT Championship. They should do Bron Breakker against Carmelo Hayes before either one of them are called up to the main roster. That is a match that I want to see. So I thought that main event was a positive. Another positive on the show on Tuesday, speaking of Breakker, was the video package they aired for Bron Breakker. It was a personality profile showing him acting and talking like a normal everyday human being. He was out fishing at a lake, talking about how this is where he goes to unwind after a big match. This is where he is most at peace, where he can just be a regular guy, a fisherman. He should adopt a fisherman suplex as his finishing move. But this is the escape for him. It's where he comes to help lift the weight that comes with being the NXT champion. He says he's got challengers coming at him from all angles, Apollo Crews being the next one. He's next in line at NXT Deadline next month. This is character development, and I loved it. He felt relatable. This is what NXT at its core was meant to be. Sometimes we get character development in segments like this, and it's very hokey. It doesn't feel authentic. It feels like they're just playing a part. That's not what this was. So I thought this was a positive. The Schism has become mildly more interesting to me since the addition of Ava Raine. I'm still not all the way there yet, but there are signs of improvement. This week, they were sitting at a table in the ring talking about Thanksgiving and what they are thankful for. Ava talked about how families are broken apart by Thanksgiving, and she's not wrong. There's always that one person who wants to talk about politics at the Thanksgiving table, and I want to jam a drumstick in their mouth to shut them up. I don't go to Thanksgiving dinner to listen to people talk politics. If I wanted to hear about politics, I would put cable news on, and I turned that shit off years ago because those people don't know what they're talking about either. I'm here for the turkey, I'm here for the noodle pudding, and the coconut macaroons. I ate so many macaroons the other day, I'm surprised I didn't turn into a fucking macaroon. So I can relate to what Ava Raine was talking about. She said blood relatives can keep a family together, but the schism, or can't keep a family together, but the schism can always be counted on. I wonder how The Rock feels about her saying that. Rip Fowler, Jagger Reed, they said some stuff. I generally tune out what they have to say. Ava brought a supposedly random fan out of the crowd into the ring to sit with them. And Joe Gacy asked the man to pledge to the holiday of Schism Invictus. And Ava gave the man a hug and then flashed an evil look before they sacrificed this man and Gacy put him through a table. You know, for a group that used to preach inclusiveness, that wasn't very inclusive of them. But I thought this was fine. And again, I'm giving more of a chance to the Schism to try to win me over a little bit more each week. But then we had the debut of two new characters on the show. Both repackaged from old characters they used to play on TV. And the jury is out on whether these turn out to be a positive or not. The Dijak thing is a huge positive for him compared to what they had him doing before. I'll get to him in a second. But we had the debut of Scripps. They have been airing these segments now on television for weeks. I haven't talked about them, but they've been airing these little segments for weeks now. For this Scripps stuff, with these cryptic voice messages being left at the WWE Performance Center. It sounded like maybe the debut of a new faction, but it turned out to be the debut of Reggie. Yes, Carmella's former sommelier, the former 24/7 champion, Reggie. With the death of the 24/7 title, he has been sent down to NXT and repackaged as Scripps. But see, it's the cool way of spelling it. It's S-C-R-Y-P-T-S. That's like China with a Y, right? That's the cool way. It's like the Dudley Boys or the Hardy Boys with a Z at the end. That's how you know they're cool. They've repackaged him as Scripps, thus dooming a gimmick that sounded like it had some actual potential. I don't know what the fuck he was wearing, but whatever it was, he needs to never wear it ever again. Wearing the worst Five Below discount lucha mask that I have ever seen. It had tassels hanging from it. He was dressed in this orange outfit. Don't tell Taz, he won't be very happy. If they wanted to conceal his identity, he would have been wearing a mask like they have Axiom wearing. So they clearly knew people would recognize him as Reggie, even though the announcers had to play dumb like they didn't know who he was. I wonder who this guy is. Right? They have to play dumb. Always dumb down to your announcers. That's always great. So he wrestles exactly like he did on TV with all the flips and all, you know, all the stuff off the top rope. He won the match quickly, 90 seconds. He does this weird hand gesture like he's scripting something in the air, which I guess is a play off of his new name. This was awful. Everything about this was terrible. A 10-foot tall man trying to climb a 5-foot fence couldn't get over with this shit. I'm glad he's off my television on Mondays, but if they're serious about pushing this guy, this ain't it. This was one of the worst debuts that I've ever seen. His costume looks like a rejected idea that would make a DVD extra 20 years from now when we look back and go, holy shit, they really dodged a bullet with that one. Like WWE wanting to call Steve Austin Chili McFreeze or Fang McFrost. Only this really happened. This is how they really debuted this guy on TV. Terrible. Then there's Donovan Dijak, and I'm so happy they're letting him use the Dijak name and not Dijakovic. We've seen the vignettes for weeks. Shawn Michaels let it slip on the post-show media call after Halloween Havoc that they were bringing Dijak back to NXT. It's been over 2 years, okay? 26 months, to be exact, since Retribution debuted on TV, and he debuted as T-Bar. That's 2 years of T-Bar. 2 years of T-Bar has been a waste of 2 years of this man's career. How do you have a talent like Donovan Dijak and waste him away for 2 years the way that they did? Shawn Michaels wanted to rescue this man and bring him back to NXT because he felt like Dijak still had unfinished business there. The jury is out on whether this will save the man's career, but it's promising that he debuted after the main event on Tuesday, laying out Wesley after he retained his North American Championship. He was dressed in all black with a long black leather jacket. He had shades on. He was looking like a taller, jacked-up version of Jay White, only without the long hair. He delivered his Feast Your Eyes finish and laid out the champion. Booker T nearly killed the entire segment when Vic Joseph blurted out, "It's Dijak," and Booker goes, "Who?" I nearly died when he said that. I get that they've never called him Dijak on TV before, but Booker, having no idea who he was just priceless. I wasn't supposed to be laughing, though. So the jury is out on where this all goes from here. But already, this is a massive step up from T-Bar and the stupid mask that they had him wearing before. There is no place for him to go but up. Now, I do wonder if they reveal that he is just a hired gun for Tony D'Angelo, who's been out with a leg injury ever since he hurt his knee wrestling Wesley. He blames Wesley for injuring him. They even aired a segment when Lee got to the building on Tuesday. He was walking through the parking lot, which is always the most dangerous place to be in NXT. Tony D'Angelo drove up next to him, and he sarcastically wished him luck later in the show. And it goes back even further. There was a backstage segment on one of the NXT shows last month where Tony D's boy, Stax, told Wesley that his actions have consequences. So my guess is that we learned that Dijak was paid off by Tony D to take out Wesley. But whether he becomes a permanent part of his act, you know, maybe as his enforcer, we'll have to wait and see. I would rather they don't do that and let Dijak do his own thing and not be attached to that, you know, any kind of gimmick silliness. So Scripps was a fail, but Dijak being repackaged was a necessary first step. I didn't see anything wrong with his look. I thought he looked fine, and I'm glad that they're finally righting the wrongs of Retribution, which will go down as one of the biggest creative blunders in the history of this company. Not one person who was part of that group came out better off for it on the other side. Mercedes Martinez had enough sense to ask out of it after the very first week because she saw what a train wreck that thing was going to be. They turned Mace into a male model. Slapjack got shit-canned. Mia Yim only first came back. It's too early to tell how she's going to end up doing. And then you have Mustafa Ali. He's never recovered. The odds are against Dijak, but I hope he gets a fair shake to show what he can do. This week's Tales from the Territories covered the Dallas territory in world-class championship wrestling. This was the Von Erichs episode, and they stayed away from all of the tragedy to keep things focused on the territory itself. So that was a nice change, because the Von Erich story is the most depressing of all the wrestling families. They're filming a movie about the family as we speak, The Iron Claw. That's the film where MJF is playing the part of Lance Von Erich, the fake Von Erich cousin. The roundtable had Kevin Von Erich, the last surviving Von Erich brother, Chavo Guerrero Jr., whose father wrestled in World Class, Jimmy Garvin of the Fabulous Freebirds, Brian Attias, who trained under Fritz Von Erich, and he was a staple for the promotion for many years, and David Manning, who was a referee and a booker for World Class. He was Fritz Von Erich's right-hand man. Kevin talked about his father being an honest and fair man. Kevin has always been very complimentary of his father. You know, it's easy to say that Fritz is this or that because of so many of his sons died of drug overdoses and suicides. He must have been overbearing. He must have been a terrible father. And maybe he was. I don't know. He has always struck me from the stories about him as somebody who probably put a lot of pressure on his sons. You know, his sons were his meal ticket after he retired. And maybe he cared more about the Von Erichs and not enough about the Atkinsons, which is their real name, right? Atkinson was their real name, not Von Erich. Maybe he cared too much about them as wrestlers and not as much as he should have as actual human beings. But the Sportatorium in Dallas has always been, you know, associated with World Class, one of the most legendary wrestling venues. It was demolished back in 2003. Kevin had a chance to tour the building one last time. They filmed that as part of that Heroes of World Class DVD that came out many years ago. Lots of classic shows took place in that venue. Lots of classic matches. World Class television has always been held up as being ahead of its time. They didn't really talk about this too much, but it has always been looked at as something that rivaled WWE, or was even better than WWE, for a while there on the production end. You know, they had things that a lot of other promotions didn't have at that time as far as how they shot television. Multiple cameras instead of just primarily a hard camera shot, handheld cameras, close-up shots. You know, you take world-class production, I mean, no pun intended, and combine world-class production with big matches and angles in front of these molten hot crowds, and you can see why world-class was regarded as one of the top promotions in the country. I mean, those Von Erich boys were like rock stars. But they had a lot of stars pass through that territory, and future stars cut their teeth there also. Dingo Warrior, right? Dingo Warrior had to crawl so the Ultimate Warrior can run to the ring like a maniac. Before The Undertaker, there was Texas Red. Cactus Jack worked there. Rick Rude, King Kong Bundy back when he had hair. Believe it or not, King Kong Bundy, once upon a time, actually had a full head of hair. It sounds wrong to me, but this is true. Now, one of the stars of World Class that they talked about was Gentleman Chris Adams, who was anything but a gentleman when he would start drinking. And unfortunately for everybody around him, he was drinking most of the time. He's a great worker. I've never heard anybody say anything bad about his in-ring work. He's the man who trained Steve Austin. And he could drink beer just fine, but once he got into the hard stuff, once he got into the hard liquor, he was an absolute maniac. You know, Adams is someone I have heard people that knew him say good things about, and then a lot of people have not so great things to say about. Steve Austin, for example, in his book called Adams a Pile of Crap and said that he screwed him over too many times. From a lot of the stories I've heard about him, the guy was an asshole. He was an absolute asshole. And the stories they told about him in the episode didn't exactly change my opinion of the guy. One story is what they called the Israel incident. World Class, for whatever reason, was super popular in Israel, of all places. The Von Erichs were huge there. On one trip over there, Chris Adams beat up a bartender really badly. And wouldn't you know it, he super kicked the bartender and knocked the poor guy's eye out of his head. Another fucking eyeball story. Did I not just tell you a few weeks ago? These old school guys, they just can't help themselves. This one sounds even more ridiculous than almost any of the other ones that I've heard. That it was a super kick that took the man's eye out. And in the reenactment, they're showing this guy on the ground. He's holding his eye, and his eye is literally out of his... Give me a fucking break with this. I mean, my God. My God, how many more of these eyeball stories are we going to have? We have two more episodes left. We have two more episodes. That means we got at least one more eyeball story probably yet to come. But it was a super kick that took this man's eye out. Now we know why CM Punk went into attack mode when the Elite stormed into his dressing room. He had to strike first. He couldn't let one of them super kick his eye out of his head. I mean, there were two of them. That's two eyes he could have lost. Then Larry would have to walk him. Chris Adams is actually the one who popularized the super kick, right down to the thigh slap, so it would make a great sound. I think he made it his finish. So depending on how you view super kicks, you can either give him credit or you can give him blame. So he super kicks the guy's eye out. Let's just go with this. This is the story. Now they have to get Chris out of the country before the cops pick him up. David Manning rushes him to the airport in a disguise and hopes that when they check his passport, he doesn't get flagged. And they check him in, no problem. He gets on the plane. Manning goes back to the hotel, and the cops are there waiting for him. And they're asking him, "What? Where's Chris Adams?" And he goes, "Well, I don't know. He played dumb." He goes, "I don't know. I haven't seen him." So he's very lucky he didn't get arrested himself. They told another Chris Adams story where he was drunk, of course, on a flight that was delayed. They made the wise decision to give a plane full of pro wrestlers free alcohol. When they eventually cut him off, Adams did not take the news very well, and he ended up headbutting the pilot, or the co-pilot, and breaking his nose. He spent 3 months in federal prison for that one, and he was arrested again years later for beating his then-girlfriend. Sounds like a real swell guy. Now, before his death, Adams was... Now, they didn't get into any of this, right? They were just telling stories about Chris Adams. Let me tell you, because you might be wondering, where is Chris Adams now? Or if you are aware of the fact that he died, how did he die? Let me tell you exactly what happened. Before his death, Chris Adams was already awaiting trial on a manslaughter charge for killing his girlfriend. They had been drinking one night. They were taking drugs. I think they were taking GHB. 12 hours later, his girlfriend was dead. And over a year later, they finally charged him with her death because in Texas, a person can be convicted of manslaughter if they're found to have recklessly caused somebody else's death. So with that hanging over his head, one night, he's hanging out with a friend. Both of them had been drinking. They started fighting. They were basically like roughhousing with each other. The friend claimed that Adams lost his temper. He started going for his eye. And he panicked. Now, there's the eye again. He started going for his eye, and he panicked. And he reached over, and he grabbed his handgun, and he hit Adams in the head with it. I guess maybe with the butt of the gun. Well, that didn't stop him. And so when that didn't stop him, I guess he felt threatened. And he shot Adams in the chest, and he killed him. I think the friend got off after pleading self-defense. Such was the tumultuous life of Chris Adams. I guess you live hard, you die hard. By the way, to go back to Israel for a second, when Kevin Von Erich first went there, he went by himself back in 85. He went for a couple of weeks. And a few months later, he and his brother Mike went back, and World Class created a Middle Eastern championship, which Mike won when he beat Gino Hernandez. Kevin claims that all commercial trade was stopped on his first day in Tel Aviv. It was packed everywhere he went. That Middle Eastern title, it's actually on display at a mall in Tel Aviv to this day. And Kevin thought so highly of the Israeli people that he wrestled his final ever match in Israel 5 years ago. He tagged with his sons, who currently wrestle for MLW. He did a tag team match over in Israel. And it was a huge deal. It aired live on a major national TV station there. I think while he was there, he filmed a couple of commercials. They had close to 2,000 people in attendance. You know, it's funny to think, as popular as the Von Erichs were in Israel, that Fritz, early in his career in Texas, he wrestled as a Nazi. That was his gimmick. When he tagged with Waldo Von Erich, they even wore SS uniforms to the ring. I guess Fritz eventually saw the error of his ways and all was forgiven. Of course, you can't do a world-class episode and not talk about the Freebirds coming to Texas. There were baby faces initially when they came in. It made the turn mean more when they did the angle at Christmas Star Wars back in 82. One of the most iconic angles of all time. It was Christmas Day. The main event was a steel cage match for the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship. Ric Flair coming in to defend against Kerry Von Erich. Michael P.S. Hayes, he was the special enforcer for the match. When Flair and Kerry both got knocked out, Hayes put Kerry on top of Flair for the three count. He wanted him to pin him. Kerry didn't want to win that way. He didn't want to win the belt that way. So Hayes argued with him. He went to go walk out of the cage. Flair shoved Kerry into Hayes, which Hayes did not see, and knocked him out of the ring. When Hayes turned around, all he saw was Kerry. He didn't know it was Flair who caused the shove. And that's when Terry Gordy on the outside slammed the cage door on Kerry's head, which ignited this whole legendary feud between the Freebirds and the Von Erichs that made that company a lot of money. And they talked about Gordy slamming the cage door on Kerry's head and how he really did. He slammed it so hard, it busted him open, it left an indent in his skull. They showed the footage. You can clearly see Kerry blading himself. I mean, who are they trying to fool here? You know what I mean? Like, I guess you got to keep kayfabe alive, but even the Israeli bartender with his one eye left in his head could clearly see that Kerry was blading himself. They talked about Jimmy Garvin being one of the first wrestlers to come to the ring with a female valet. He had two of them at one point, Sunshine and Precious. One was his real-life cousin, the other one was his wife. And there ended up being serious heat between them because they would work together and they would have their little cat fights. They would really lay their shit in on each other. So Garvin said that he would cringe at how hard they would hit each other. They shared a few other stories on the episode. That was largely it, honestly. I mean, all the really deep stuff with the world-class promotion and the Von Erichs has to do with the deaths, right? The deaths of David and Mike and Chris and Kerry. And they stayed away from all that because it's already been well documented and they didn't want the episode to be a total downer. They only have 44 minutes or whatever it is, right? I mean, if you're going to cover all the death and despair, it's going to be the entire episode. So they stayed away from that. I thought it was fine. It was not one of their stronger episodes. I'd put it down around where the Stampede episode was. This week, though, should be good. It's Jim Crockett Promotions, and they aired a commercial for it. They have Arn Anderson, Ricky Morton, Baby Doll, and Jim Cornette for the show. So that's going to be a good one. And then after that, it's just the Mid-South episode, and we're all done here. But we're not all done here. Not yet, because we still have your mailbag questions. I'll go through some of them here. Keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I love to hear from you guys. Kevin in Albany, we'll start with him. Did WWE book themselves into a corner with Roman Reigns remaining a double champion for this long? Crazy things like Austin Theory's decision to cash in Money in the Bank on the U.S. title and Charlotte's challenge to the NXT champion a couple of years ago. But the Rumble winner challenges WWE champion for WrestleMania, which is a lot of TV time in between. If The Rock or another part-timer wins the Rumble, that leaves a big absence before, as likely Rock and Reigns won't be interacting very much before WrestleMania. Do you see WWE doing something outside the box or different with this year's Royal Rumble on the men's side? Maybe Sammy or Jay win but have to give up the challenge or face Roman in February instead. I think Sammy winning the Royal Rumble is definitely a possibility. I don't think I would do that. I still feel Cody should win. But Sammy could win, yeah. And if he does, he's not getting the match at WrestleMania. I think it would take place in Montreal in February. But other than that, I don't know what else you do with the Royal Rumble other than having somebody just win it straight up. I mean, you talk about thinking outside the box and doing some... Again, they, like you said, they boxed themselves into a corner here by not splitting these titles earlier. And I don't know what they're going to do. James says, was watching your Raw review and it got me thinking, if WWE is going to do Rock and Roman at Mania for the title, how do they get to that match? You absolutely cannot have Rock win the Royal Rumble, so I was thinking about this. How about Roman Reigns pulls double duty at the Rumble? Have him defend the Universal title against Sheamus or Owens, and then later that night you have him defend the WWE title in the Royal Rumble match. Have the Rumble come down to Roman and Cody. Cody eliminates Roman and wins the WWE Championship that way. Roman doesn't have to eat a pin, and WWE gets Rock and Roman at Mania, still just for the Universal title. And at SummerSlam, you do Bray and Roman for the Universal title, and that's where you pin Roman and his reign ends for good. That is not the way I would want to see the WWE title put on Cody. If you're going to do Roman and Cody, you're going to have Cody win the belt. It's got to be one-on-one. Yeah, I think it's got to be a singles match, preferably at WrestleMania. I don't like that idea. And again, you know, we talk about having Roman pull double duty, but what's the impetus for that? Is there a general manager I'm not aware of who's going to show up on TV and say, Roman Reigns, you're going to be defending both titles at the Rumble, including in the Rumble itself? Like, what is the storyline explanation for that? You'd have to come up with a hell of an explanation. And I don't see that happening. Although Roman and KO, I expect that to be the match at the Rumble. But yeah, I don't want to see Cody win the title that way. Casey says, if Rock agrees to do Mania next year, when would you predict The Rock would make a cameo to tease it? Would it be Survivor Series? Would it be the Royal Rumble? Or would it be Monday Night Raw? Well, we didn't see him last night. We're not going to see him at the Royal Rumble. So I think it would be on an episode of either SmackDown or Raw, more likely on SmackDown. SmackDown's his show anyway. Out of Control, Cody from Oklahoma City. What's going on, Cody? I hope you had a good Thanksgiving, he says. I'm sending this question before War Games, but I'm watching the 1997 episodes of Raw and it gave me an idea. What would you think if Sami Zayn brought Santa to SmackDown for Jey Uso, going back to 25 years ago when Santa was on Raw and wanted Sable to sit on his lap, but instead got a young Jey Uso? You know, until you mentioned that in your email, I forgot that was Jey Uso in that segment. I think it'd be a fun little callback. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that. I think they could have some fun with that. Especially now that Sami and Jey, they're all buddy-buddy, right? Sami's going to get him a nice gift for the holidays. Nier from Israel. I heard Sting talk constantly about his desire to have a match with The Undertaker. The question was it also the other way around? I never heard Undertaker talking about wanting to do a match with Sting, and quite frankly, I never heard him mention Sting at all, which makes me wonder if he appreciated Sting in the first place. I don't know if he appreciated him or not. I wish somebody would have asked him more about that when he was making the rounds and doing all those interviews. Or I don't know if he takes questions at those one-man shows that he does now. Maybe somebody can ask the question. I never got the impression that Undertaker really wanted to work with him. I don't know what he thought of him personally. I don't know how much they interacted back when he was Mean Mark in WCW. I don't recall them working together. Maybe they had a match, but yeah, I mean, Sting was constantly going on and on and on about wanting to work a match with The Undertaker, but yeah, I never heard Undertaker ever reciprocate that at all, so I never got the impression it was something he wanted. I think that he would have preferred to work with people that he was already friendly with and knew and had a chemistry with, like a Shawn Michaels or an Undertaker, and if not them, or I'm sorry, Shawn Michaels or a Triple H, and if not them, he would have preferred to be in the ring with like an AJ Styles, right? Somebody who was a little bit younger, a little bit more spry, who can bump around for him and make him look good. And maybe he just felt, you know, Sting's another old guy like me. I mean, you know, I don't want to work with somebody like that. I don't know. Steve from Virginia, what are your top three favorite Elimination Chamber matches of all time? So I started thinking about that when I got the question. 2017. With Bray Wyatt winning the WWE Championship. I thought that was an excellent Elimination Chamber match. The first one at Survivor Series in 2002, which we just did a watch-along for. And I'm going to throw 2019 on there, with Daniel Bryan retaining the WWE title and Kofi Kingston falling just short at the end. That was right before the whole Kofi Mania thing exploded. Kofi wasn't even supposed to be in the chamber. I think he got Mustafa Ali spot when he got hurt. But that 2019 one was very, very good. So I got two very similar questions about CM Punk's year in AEW. But they're different enough. I'll answer them both. We'll start with Yandi from South Africa. If you were to put aside the reasons why CM Punk left AEW and judge him solely on his in-ring work in his first months back and compare it to that of Shawn Michaels in his first 12 months back, I guess he's talking back in 2002, who had the better run? And I thought that was a very interesting question. I would go with Shawn Michaels, in part because Punk missed almost 3 months of his first year in AEW with the broken foot. Shawn had that fantastic comeback match with Triple H. He won the world title in that, you know, the great Elimination Chamber match at Survivor Series. He had the Three Stages of Hell match with Triple H. He wrestled Chris Jericho at WrestleMania. Had a pretty good match with Ric Flair that summer. He worked a second Elimination Chamber match at SummerSlam. That was the one that had Goldberg in it. You know, his body of work was pretty damn good that first year back. Punk had great matches, too. He had great matches with Darby, Eddie Kingston, Dax Harwood on Dynamite, the feud with MJF, the dog collar match at Revolution. It's not a slam dunk win for Shawn Michaels or anything. You know, if Punk didn't miss those 2.5 months, I probably still would go with Shawn Michaels, but it would be a lot closer. But I got to go with HBK. Now, Justin from Columbia, Maryland had a similar question. Again, these two sent them in from two very different parts of the world, so it's just kind of weird how that worked out. But he said, assuming CM Punk is finished in AEW, buy or sell, Bret Hart's final year in WWE as a full-time performer from Survivor Series 96 to Survivor Series 97, or CM Punk's only year in AEW from All Out 2021 to All Out 2022. And he says that's with no particular qualifier to judge either year. Interested to hear your take on who you believe had the better year. I mean, Bret Hart in 1997, I mean, that was maybe his best year. When you look at his body of work and the heel turn and the Hart Foundation stuff and some of the matches he had that year, he also was hurt for a while. He missed a little bit of time. He had a knee scope. That's when he was on TV being pushed around in the wheelchair. And he was supposed to wrestle Shawn Michaels at the King of the Ring in a 10-minute match, and he couldn't do the match. So he also had some downtime due to an injury, but my God, I mean, Bret Hart in 97, I can't vote against that. It's like his greatest run. Look at his body of work. Survivor Series, when he came back, he had that match at Madison Square Garden with Steve Austin. Then he had the match with Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13, one of the greatest matches of all time. Then the heel turn, the formation of the Hart Foundation. He had that SummerSlam match with The Undertaker with that great finish, with Shawn Michaels as the referee. We all know what happened in Montreal, but it's hard. You know, you say no particular qualifier, so we're not just judging it based on the in-ring work, but I can't, in good conscience, vote against Bret Hart in 1997. I mean, come on, that's one of the great runs of all time here. Jerome from Sin City, USA. Mr. Perfect was the replacement for the Ultimate Warrior at Survivor Series when he got fired in 1992. Do you know what the original plan was to bring him back if the Warrior was not fired? I'm not aware of there being a plan for Perfect to return. I think he was happy collecting his Lloyd's of London money. He was getting those insurance checks. And Vince McMahon had to pony up, you know, he had to pay up to get him back in the ring. I'm glad he did, because we never would have gotten that Bret Hart, Mr. Perfect, King of the Ring match if he didn't come back when he did. But I'm not aware of there being any immediate plan to get Perfect back in the ring. I think he was just content to collect his money. And last but not least, we'll go to Dylan in Toronto. See, we bounce around here. We go from South Africa to the U.S. Now we go up to Canada. We're hitting all the important points on the map here. Buy, sell, and rent. On which of these matches would be the biggest wrestling sin to watch on mute? So the match that you buy on being the greatest sin to watch on mute, whereas the match that you sell on is the least offensive to watch on mute. Okay, so that's the grading scale here. And he says, Rock against Hogan in Toronto at WrestleMania 18, the 1992 Royal Rumble, and Rock against Mankind on Monday Night Raw from January 2nd, 1999. Actually, it was January 4th. It was taped in December, but it aired on January. That date will always be burned in my brain. January 4th, 1999. I'm going to buy on Rock and Hogan at WrestleMania 18. I think that crowd is as much a part of the lore of that match and how great that match was as anything that happened in the ring. And you put that match on mute, and the match is not nearly as good. So you have to buy on Rock and Hogan at WrestleMania 18. I'm going to rent on the 1992 Royal Rumble match. It's a sin to watch that match without the commentary of the Gorilla in the Brain, but I'm going to rent on that. I'm going to sell on the Rock and Mankind match. Yeah, that sounds about right to me. So some good questions, interesting questions this week, and keep sending them on in. You never know when I may answer them. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. If you missed my full Survivor Series review, of course, the video version is up on YouTube right now. All nearly 2.5 hours of it. So it's never too late to go hit the like button on the videos, which does help them out quite a bit. Leave a comment underneath. So that's up on YouTube. I'll get the audio pushed out as soon as I can. I'm going to be back with you next Sunday. Episode 785, the first sound off of the month of December. As we wind down 2022, we're barreling towards the end of the year. I guess that means I got to start giving some thought to my end of the year stuff, huh? I hadn't even thought about that until just now. I got to start giving some thought to that. Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Thank you for all of the support and for choosing me for your podcast listening every week and tuning in and supporting the show. And I'll see you back here next Sunday for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
So I brought a pecan pie, and I bought a little thing of coconut macaroon. When they put dessert out on the table, there were about 15 of us. I will tell you, do you know the one pie that was completely devoured when the night was over? My pie. The pecan pie was the one that went first. You still had half the apple pie. You had almost all that pumpkin shit. The tower of fruit was basically untouched, except for a few grapes. But the pecan pie was gone. I know that because I went back for seconds and it was gone and I was pissed. See? Solemonster brings the good shit. I don't bring that inferior crap. I bring only the best.
The Solemonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks. And follow the Solemonster on Twitter at Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster. Solemonster Sounds Off.